Morning.
Good morning.
Hi. So this morning I'm going to read a Chinese fairy tale that I've not read for 3 or 4 years. Which is in the Gateless Barrier, the Koan collection, the Gateless Barrier. But I'm just going to talk about the story. We'll see if it's an Easter story or not. Who knows? It could be. Could be. There lived in Hanyang a man called Chang Qian, whose child daughter Qian was of peerless beauty. He had also a nephew called Wang Chao, a very handsome boy. He had also enough. The children played together and were fond of each other. Once Qian jestingly said to this nephew, "Someday I will marry you to my little daughter." Both children remembered these words, and they believed themselves thus betrothed. When Qian grew up, a man of rank asked for her in marriage, and her father decided to comply with the demand. Qian was greatly troubled by this decision. As for Chao, he was so much angered and grieved that he resolved to leave home and go to another province. The next day, he got a boat ready for his journey, and after sunset, without bidding farewell to anyone, he proceeded up the river. But in the middle of the night, he was startled by a voice calling to him, "Wait, it is I!" And he saw a girl running along the bank toward the boat. It was Qian. Chao was unspeakably delighted. She sprang into the boat, and the lovers found their way safely to the province of Chu. In the province of Chu, they lived happily for 6 years, and they had 2 children. But Qian could not forget her parents, and often longed to see them again. At last, she said to her husband, "Because in former times I could not bear to break the promise made to you, I ran away with you and forsook my parents, although knowing that I owed them all possible duty and affection. Would it now be well to try to obtain their forgiveness?" "Don't grieve yourself about that," said Chao. "We'll go see them." He ordered a boat to be prepared, and a few days later he returned with his wife to Hanyang. According to custom in such cases, the husband first went to the house of Qian, leaving Qian alone in the boat. Qian welcomed his nephew with every sign of joy and said, "How much I've been longing to see you." "Hi." Looks like there are a couple more people coming in, so maybe I'm pausing. I lost my place. Let's see. "How much I've been longing to see you. I was often afraid that something had happened to you." Chao answered respectfully, "I'm distressed by the undeserved kindness of your words. It is to beg your forgiveness that I've come." But Qian did not seem to understand. He asked, "To what matter do you refer?" "I feared," said Chao, "that you were angry with me for having run away with Qian. I took her with me to the province of Chu." "What Qian was that?" asked Qian. "Your daughter Qian," answered Chao, beginning to suspect his father-in-law of some malevolent design. "What are you talking about?" cried Qian, with every appearance of astonishment. "My daughter Qian has been sick in bed all these years, ever since the time when you went away." "Your daughter Qian," returned Chao, becoming angry, "has not been sick. She's been my wife for 6 years, and we have 2 children, and we have both returned to this place only to seek your pardon. Therefore, please do not mock us." For a moment, the two looked at each other in silence. Then Qian arose and motioned to his nephew to follow, leading the way to an inner room where a sick girl was lying. And Chao, to his utter amazement, saw the face of Qian. beautiful but strangely thin and pale. She can't speak, explained the old man, but she can understand. And Kien said to her laughingly, Chao tells me that you ran away with him, that you gave him two children. The sick girl looked at Chao and smiled, but remained silent. Now come with me to the river, said the bewildered visitor to his father-in-law, for I can assure you, in spite of what I have seen in this house, that your daughter Qian is at this moment in my boat. They went to the river, and there indeed was the young wife waiting. And seeing her father, she bowed down before him and sought his pardon. Qian said to her, If you really be my daughter, I have nothing but love for you. Yet, though you seem to be my daughter, there is something which I can't understand. Come with us to this house. So the three proceeded toward the house. As they neared it, they saw that the sick girl, who had not before left her bed for years, was coming to meet them, smiling as if much delighted. And the two Qians appeared to each other and approached each other. But then, nobody could ever tell how, suddenly they melted into each other and become one body, one person, one Qian, even more beautiful than before and showing no sign of sickness or of sorrow. Qian said to Chao, Ever since the day of your going, my daughter was dumb, and most of the time like a person who had taken too much wine. Now I know that her spirit was absent. Qian herself said, Really, I never knew that I was at home. I saw Chao going away in silent anger, and the same night I dreamed that I ran after his boat. But now I cannot tell which was really I, the I that went away in the boat, or the I that stayed at home. Ah, so des ne, as Katagiri Roshi would say. So des ne, so it is, so it is. So, how often do we separate ourselves? We split ourselves off. Do we disconnect ourselves from a vitally important part of ourselves, whether it be our heart or our mind? How often are we sitting here, right here, thinking about what we're going to be doing after coffee? How often, when we're having coffee, are we thinking about what we're going to be doing the next day? How often is our heart one place and our mind another place? How often? Pretty often, huh? Pretty often. Listening to my talk, how often does your mind wander off? How often do you have to bring it back? How often are we fragmented and split so that we're living at home but not really home? How often? Not really home. Just like a phantom. Bunch of phantoms, a bunch of ghosts. How can we have vital energy if we're investing always in these splits? And this what should have been, or what might have been, or what he did to me, or what he could do to me, or what I should do to him, or myself. Split, split, split. Wasting our psychic energy, wasting our heart mind, our big, full heart mind. And, of course, in this story, this is a story of what a psychologist would call, well, of course, it's even beyond that, extreme disassociation. Extreme disassociation. But in little ways, we do this all the time, and it's consider our illness from the Zen point of view, from the Buddhist point of view. That's our illness. The illness is not our physical suffering. Not the pain in my back or my shoulders. That's just pain. It's the splitting. And a key turning point in this story is Qian's longing, her aspiration to return home. That's the key turning point in the story. That's what makes it a Zen story, is that at some point she knew that she she had neglected her home, that she was far away from home, that she just wanted to return to home. So that's her aspiration. That's our aspiration in Zen practice, in Buddhism. Our aspiration to return home. To return to our true nature. Even if you don't know what your true nature is. It's not something anyway. It's not something. But you have a true nature. You have a true nature. It's always calling you back. But you get so wound up in things that you don't hear her. You don't hear her. The heart yearning to return to its own subtleness, its own initial peace, because it's the heart. It's undivided. It's peaceful. And it yearns to be recognized by us. It yearns for us to return to just being it. Just being it. And our Zazen practice, our meditation practice, is patiently refusing the domination of our opinions and our fantasies. When they're splitting us off and just turning back to embrace being here with whatever is. That's all Zen practice is. But it's a big all. It's a big all. I realize that. I realize that. So, Chen did it. We too can reunite with our sick self and become one. It doesn't mean we won't be sick anymore. But we won't be split in our sickness. If you're not split in your sickness, it's okay to be sick. It's really quite okay to be sick. Because it's just what is. Just what is. So Zen practice is a way, an invitation to discover our affinity with all these split off parts of ourselves, right? With all these ways we split our heart up, but my infatuation of him and my hatred of her and my hopes about you, we split off. We're mending that split. We're mending that rift by calling back those shards. By calling back those shards that've gotten lodged in other places. But it's our own heart mind. It's our own heart mind. So we call back the shards and we return to this wholeness, to this fullness. That's our practice. That's what Zen practice is. It's nothing else than that. Nothing else than that. And then we hear one note of the shakuhachi. One note of the shakuhachi and our heart just overflows with love. One sound of a leaf coming down. And we overflow with joy. We don't know where it comes from. It's not us. We don't know what it is. Because we've returned to our heart mind. We feel an affinity with that leaf, with that note of the shakuhachi, with that pain in my back. An affinity with all of it, with all of it. But not in some abstract intellectual way. This isn't about that stuff. Full. The intellect splits off. This is not about that. Not about that. So supposedly, a Zen master has healed the rifts within his heart mind, within her heart mind. So the borders of the mosaic that make up all the components of consciousness no longer have big gaps in them, big rifts within them. Instead, there's this wonderful, lively interconnection. So I was lucky when I was a young man to meet someone who seemed to be a Zen master. And I've talked about him a lot. And I met him around Easter in 1964. You see, I'm very old, you guys. I was having breakfast with a couple of my friends on Friday, and we were talking about our aches and pains. And my friend and my friend Norm said to me, "Well, Tim, you know, we're old men now." That's a little bit hard for me to accept. I want to split off from that one. I want to split off. Can I get a little split off from that part? Well, we're old men. In about Easter 1964, I met a man who seemed to be a Zen master, whatever that was. He didn't seem to be split. He seemed to be really alive right here with this. I didn't know much, but I had a feeling about him. I had a feeling about him. And he was not known then. There were just a few of us. Later became very famous after I left, so I missed all the pomp and circumstance. And then I went home and I saw my father, whom I dissed a lot, but I was actually quite close to in a lot of my life. And I told my father about meeting such a man, and my father said to me, he's my father's side, and he said to me, "Well, Tim, I hate to disappoint you, but I think you're off track if you think you can find abiding happiness. I think you're off track if you think you can find abiding happiness." Because my father knew suffering very well, and he knew how people cover up their suffering with church activities and being pious and repressing and suppressing and disassociating. He knew all that stuff. He was a pretty good existentialist, actually. He said, "You know, that stuff's all bullshit. That stuff's all bullshit. Life is pain. Life is pain." And of course, that's the first teaching of Buddhism. But life is pain. Life is pain. And it's also the last teaching of Buddhism. I mean, not for me, because I still have as much pain as I did when I started. But Buddhism, we also say, especially in Zen, that pain is a doorway into deep joy. And it doesn't matter what kind of pain it is. It's a doorway into deep joy. And with our practice, we can discover this. And there's no rift. There's no rift. You know, in Sanskrit, there are the terms dukkha and sukha. Well, when you look at them in the Sanskrit, they almost look the same. It's just the D and the S. Of course, it's not in Sanskrit. It's even harder to tell the difference. And what is? This is the path that Buddha talked about. From dukkha, from pain, from suffering, to sukha, to happiness. But this is Zen. In Zen, it's through dukkha. You don't get to go over it. You don't get to go around it. You don't get to split it off. It's through dukkha. That's where the sukha is. And they're not different. Because in the suffering itself is the life, is the vitality of the universe, of everything. And then we don't need to split. Splitting is a cop-out. But we're kind of fragile beings, so maybe we need to split for a while. But as your zazen gets pretty strong, I don't mean strong like this. I mean strong like this, soft, strong. Soft, strong. Then you don't need to split so much. You don't need to split at all, because right in the middle of it is deep joy. Deep joy. But it's not yours. It's not Chen's. It's not Tim's. It's not Ben's. It's a joy of life itself. The joy of the leaves and the the floor expressing its graininess. So, at that time in my life, I turned away from my father and turned toward this man. And I probably became a little bit of a, what would you say, hero worshiper of him. So I probably did a little splitting. But, you know, he always pushed me back on the cushion. So I didn't get to split very much. As he said, you know, it's not about me, it's about you doing this. Not about me, it's about you guys doing this. Each of you doing this yourselves. That's what it's about. Discovering right in the middle of the worst ache, something wonderful. Something that is beyond some idea of salvation rising from the dead. Because it's always alive in death. In life, it doesn't know. It doesn't know the difference. It doesn't split it off. So, for years when I practiced Zen here in Minneapolis, my next door neighbor was an ER doctor. Oh, my friend, Terry. And he used to talk about his practice, and I would talk about my practice. Different kind of practice, huh? Well, but maybe not entirely different. I mean, what did Katagiri Roshi used to say? What did he used to say? Life is an emergency case. Life is an emergency case. What did my friend Terry, my ER doctor friend, say to me? He said, every time when I go to work, I aspire. He said, I aspire to put everything aside to compassionately take care of whatever disease is there. And I never know what kind of disease is going to be there. And my shifts are long, and the ER shifts are long. But I aspire just to be there. Just to be there. So that I can take care of that dis-ease. That's what we aspire in our Zen practice. Just to be here. Let the disease, let the split come up. Be with it. Don't do anything about it. Just be with it. This lack of ease, this lack of ease, and allow it to heal. The amazing thing is that if you're just with it, it heals on its own. The rift heals on its own. How can that be? How can that be? We have no idea. We have no idea. But it happens. It happens. So we're finishing a practice period here at Zen Center, 8 weeks of practice period. And the last talk that I gave, which was about 10 days ago, I talked about Dylan's phrase, my love, she speaks like silence, without ideals or violence. She knows there's no success like failure, and failure is no success at all. And then I gave people a homework assignment, and I asked them to consider, those who wanted to consider during their week, when they were making effort, where their ideals fit into their effort. Were they making effort with an ideal present, and was it helping them, or was it getting in the way? And just to focus on that, I asked them. And folks came back and they said, well, this was interesting. And somebody said, well, or somebody asked me actually, well, what was it? What's the difference between aspiration and expectation? Because expectation, ideal, gets in the way all the time. It gets in the way. And then we're violent. We're violent. Look at all of the radical communal movements in the history of this country. They started out with some wonderful ideal, including our 60s thing that we did. And after a while, they turned violent. They turned violent. The more we cling to the ideal, the more we get split. We split. And we become violent. But what about aspiration? This is we need to aspire. We have to aspire. I aspire to practice Zen meditation. I still aspire to practice Zen meditation. I still aspire to just sit with whatever riffs come up. What's the difference between aspiration and expectation? Someone asked me, and I mumbled something. Well, now I'm going to try to say something a little more articulate. But I still don't know. But aspiration, I said, comes from the heart. That's what I said. Really, aspiration comes from what Suzuki Groshi, my first teacher, called beginner's mind. If we have beginner's mind, we're not so much focused on getting something. If we do something with freshness, without some real aspiration inside, without expecting a specific result, our beginner's mind is there, and it's more likely that that will help us return to this big heart mind, this big full heart mind. So it's April out, and April, and where I come from, which is California, it's time for planning. Time for planning. Big planning. I just talked to my sister on the phone yesterday, and she was out planting. But then yesterday also I looked out the window at my wife, and you know this is an unusual April in Minnesota. And what was she out doing? She was out working in the garden. And she was actually putting the shovel in the soil. And this is April, and this is eastern Minnesota, and she's putting the shovel in the soil? For years, I lived in northern Minnesota, and we would come down on Easter, and by the time we would, usually in Easter in northern Minnesota, there'd be 3 feet of snow on the ground. By the time we get to down here, maybe there are only 3 or 6 inches on the ground. But this year, ooh, that's another topic. That's another topic. The point is that with a beginner's mind, we just stick our shovel in the soil. We just aspire to grow something, and we don't know. We don't know. We just clear out the mulch and look at the soil and aspire to grow something. But we don't have a specific expectation. If we do, we get disappointed pretty soon. For those of you who have gardened, you get disappointed pretty soon. Because some wind comes along, or a drought, or mealybugs, or something. But if you just come back to the soil, if you just come back to the bare ground, just cultivating the bare ground, just digging it up, aerating it, putting some more mulch in it, putting a little, not unnatural fertilizer, natural fertilizer, singing to it as you dig. You won't lose your beginner's mind. And whatever grows out of that ground will be amazing. You'll be amazed. And of course, since you're a beginner, you'll think the piece of clover is already the beginning of your corn your corn plant. So you still need your common sense. You shouldn't lose your common sense. So when we lived in northern Minnesota, we decided we would farm. We would homestead because we were Zen counterculture people, right? And that's what you did, even in northern Minnesota. And my wife's brother came to visit us from California, and he said to her, he was 10 years older than her. He said it so I could hear him, but he didn't say it to me directly. He said to her, "Linda, you and Tim lack common sense." They lived in Lafayette, California, in a beautiful home. Well, I won't get into all that. Anyway, there we were up in northern Minnesota, trying, and this was early May. trying to cultivate the ground in early May, you lack common sense. So in a way, Zen practice is not about common sense. It's not about common sense. From a common sense point of view, just to sit doing nothing, day after day after day, what are you going to get from that? I mean, what are you going to get from that? When they're all the things you should be doing, you have to be doing, you love to be doing, you hate to be doing. It's nonsensical. Of course, if you follow some program, some meditation program, where you're going to get from A to B to C to D, then it's sensible. And of course, Buddhism has those programs. But Katagiri Roshi and Suzuki Roshi had no programs like that. Nada. I teach those programs sometimes, but they had nothing like that. Because they were only interested in showing us how to be where we are. To take care of this bare ground. And by doing that, heal the rift that we create in the world. When we just grab on to this perfect tomato plant. Instead of coming back, the perfect tomato plant means nothing. If you don't relate to it as it grows, if you don't put the seed in the ground, if you don't watch it, the plant come out of the seed, if you do that, once you have the plant, you don't feel like it's your plant. You know it's your not plant. It's the plant of life, and you want to share the tomatoes with everyone. You just can't help it. They're not your tomatoes. They are your tomatoes. They're all our tomatoes. One tomato plant. You know, one tomato plant? We used to grow a lot of tomato plants. One tomato plant, if you really take care of the ground, if you really mulch the garden, if you really proliferates with tomatoes. Quite amazing. So my teacher Suzuki Roshi used to talk about how we like food from the refrigerator. He didn't know about the freezer. He must have known about the freezer, but no, he didn't. You know, if you read his book, if you read about Crooked Cucumber, he didn't know about the freezer. No way. And he said, instead, be interested in how to produce food from the field, from the garden, from the ground. That's true aspiration. That's true aspiration. When we just come back to the ground, sometimes the ground's not very fertile. Some kinds of soil has lots of cracks in it, lots of rifts in it. But if we just take care of those cracks, if we just dig into them gently, kindly, steadily, adding organic material, coming back to the ground again and again with our breathing, with our posture, with whatever we need to do to come back here, we discover a happiness that can't be packaged. It just can't be packaged. Can't be frozen. It can be frozen, but then it's gone. It's dead. It's dead. And the food we eat doesn't have vitality anymore because that's packaged happiness. Well, what's that? What's that? It's not the happiness of our heart mind, of our original still nature, which is always calling for us. So my first teacher didn't think of himself as a Zen master. When people said he was good, he said, if so, it's because my students are good. And that's how he felt. If so, it's because my students are good. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. He wore $2 glasses that he got from Walgreens. $1.99, he told me. $1.99 on sale. Because he was so absent-minded. And he kept them on a string so he could keep them around his neck so he wouldn't lose them. But he always lost them anyway. Uh-huh. and his favorite food was potatoes. And one time at the monastery, the head cook, the Tenzo, we didn't know it was his birthday. We didn't even know he liked potatoes, but he served us all potatoes in the big bowl, in the medium-sized bowl, and the little bowl. For those of you who know what Zen formality is, we were pissed. We were pissed. And then after he served it, he said, "Happy birthday, Suzuki Roshi." And Roshi said, "Thank you very much. My favorite food." Then we were not pissed anymore. Then we were, oh. When you appreciate beginner's mind, when you just appreciate the mind that is already, that you don't cultivate, you'll be overjoyed if someone gives you a potato to eat. You'll be overjoyed by its texture, by its look, by its feel, and by how it nurtures you. Just one bite of a little potato gives you all the nutrition you need. So if you do this kind of beginner's mind practice, little by little, the rifts within your heart will heal. The rifts between your heart and your mind will heal. The rifts between yourselves and others will heal on their own. On their own. So to paraphrase a poem, sitting quietly, doing nothing. Spring comes and the rifts heal by themselves. That's my talk for Easter Sunday, you guys. Questions? Comments? Sure.
It has to do with your story that you started that way.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if the story is about association, or is it maybe also about something else? I was thinking about, what's her name?
Qian.
Yeah. I thought she really didn't have much of a choice. And it wasn't really because she got herself in that situation. It was brought upon her.
That's right. Yes, there are many different takes on this story. This story actually is not a Zen story. it's an old Chinese fairy tale that has many, many different connotations. I chose to just talk about it from one point of view, but there are many, many ways to talk about it. But it is primarily about whether we have a choice or not, about how we split ourselves. And you could say she didn't have a choice, but often we don't have choices. But often we have to split up to protect ourselves. Life calls us to do that. I mean, I really had to split off from my dad at a time in my life to protect myself. It didn't feel good. It didn't feel good. But it was necessary. It was necessary. But every time there's a split, there's a potential for healing. There's a potential for healing. And we don't know when the potential is gonna be there, but if we're patient, if we're still, we can look for that potential. My father, I split off from him when I was, well, how old was I when that house? 1964. I'd have to add the math, but I'm just going to turn 69 soon, so you tell me. I needed that rift. I needed that space. But I worked then for years to heal it. And finally, it healed. But after it healed, after I quit working on it, and I just hung out with him, I quit telling him about Zen, and just hung out with him. just thought of, just treated him as Buddha herself. If your dad's not Buddha herself, who is, right? So I think there are many, and sometimes we need to repress stuff. It's healthy to repress something, some real pain, because we're not in a situation where we can deal with it. But then through sitting practice, when we're ready, we can heal that wound. We can just let it come in and heal it. She didn't have much choice. Sometimes we don't have much choice. And it's not bad. Yeah, it's our circumstance. It's life. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Did you have something more about that? Okay. 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 Anybody else? Anything else? Well, happy Easter. And let's all rise from the dead. Let's rise from the dead together and enjoy this wonderful Easter. Okay? Okay? Healing all the rifts as we rise. Knowing that they will occur again. And that we can yet rise again. Rising and falling. Rising and falling.